We're there. Good afternoon and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have been alarmed, as you have, by the rise in brutal anti-Semitism in Europe, in countries that have been considered friendly to Israel, the Netherlands, the UK, France, Ireland. Okay, Ireland is not always particularly friendly. But still, the rise has been alarming. And now we're seeing a rise of violent activities in the United States against Jews, culminating in the murder of two young people at a DC Jewish event, and the Molotov cocktail bombing of a group of senior citizens in Boulder, Colorado, who were marching in support of Israel's hostages in Gaza. We are not quite at European levels, but the concern is there. And so today we are going to look at the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe and the brave people, non-Jewish friends of Israel and the Jews, fighting back. If there are lessons out there for our own country, we want to know what they are. Our guest today is Thomas Sandel of the European Coalition for Israel. He's been on the front lines and he's going to share with us. So today we're going to do the short form of the JPC commercial. We were founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by academics, scholars, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The spring issue of In Focus is up now. It is our domestic issue. And the summer issue will be up this month. That is our Israel issue. To be honest, it's like an America-Israel issue because the separation of our concerns about Israel and our concerns about the United States is getting narrower and narrower. At the same time, I hope you've been checking our website for updates in the In Context file. We're running a lot of political and military reports. If you want a military understanding of Israel's war in Gaza, please read the military experts, John Spencer, Brian Cox, Richard Kemp, Andrew Fox. You know who they are. You can find a lot of that on our website. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny it. And now more than ever, we support the government and the IDF in their defense of the people and in bringing the perpetrators of October 7th to justice, ensuring that Hamas has neither military nor governing power in Gaza and bringing the hostages home. And finally, and bringing an end to the malign influence of Iran. For Israel's sake, yes, but also for America's sake and to bring about broad regional peace in the Middle East. And now our guest. Thomas Sandel. Thomas is the founder and director of the European Coalition for Israel, a pan-European Christian grassroots movement in support of Israel. The organization has its office in Brussels, where it monitors the policies of the European Union, not our favorite organization. So I'm going to give you a description of the European Coalition that I loved. In 2000, Elie Wiesel was invited to speak to a crisis summit hosted by the European Commission to speak about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. If he was doing that in 2000, what would he think today? In his speech, Elie Wiesel explained how disappointed and helpless he felt, and as if nobody except Jewish communities seemed to be reacting to the rise of anti-Semitism. Where are all the others? He asked. The European Coalition for Israel was formed as a response to the question. It is the coalition of the others, meaning non-Jews, who felt it was their moral obligation to stand up for the Jewish people and the State of Israel in a time of threat. Before helping to found the ECI in 2004, Thomas was an EU-accredited journalist in Brussels. He has appeared in media everywhere you think he should, including the Wall Street Journal, the International Herald Tribune, Jerusalem Post. Today, he splits his time between Brussels and Helsinki. And I'm going to start him off with a question. Thomas, how did you get into this?
That's a good question that I'm asking myself many times. I have an anecdote, which I think is the best answer I can think of, because I took a taxi in Helsinki out to the airport, and the taxi driver was looking at me and he said, "Hey, I recognize you from television. You're this guy who's speaking up for Israel. And why do you do it?" Taxi driver was Jewish, so he said, "Well, you're not Jewish, so why are you doing it?" Then he stopped himself and he said, "Well, I know." And I was very surprised. And I said, "Well, that's interesting. Let me hear." And he said, "You didn't choose this, someone else did." And he was pointing, upwards. So I think for me, I could think of many rational, answers to the question. But at the end of the day, I think he was onto something. And I usually trust the taxi drivers. They have much more knowledge than most commentators and academics.
To go media personalities versus taxi drivers. I'm going taxi drivers. So give us a picture. We think, or at least I think as an American Jew, that Europe is a terrible place right now for Jews. We are not as bad. Europe is worse. Tell us what's going on. Tell us, first of all, how bad it is. And secondly, how do governments in Europe respond to this? Is there any movement in the direction of understanding the depth of the problem?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that Europe is very diverse. When we say it's difficult, true, in certain places in Europe, it's terrible. We look at London, we look at Brussels, we look at Amsterdam, the list goes on. But on the other hand, if we look at what we used to call Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czechia, the list goes on. Things have not changed so much necessarily. So first of all, it's important to make that distinction. But when we look at old Europe, as we used to call it, yes, things are getting out of hand. And I think that media, academia, the political class is partly to be blamed, because when you hear these modern blood labels, libels, on a daily basis, I have my other news sources, but you think of the normal European citizen. Of course he's going to believe it. Of course he's going to be more and more turned against not only Israel but the Jewish people. And then there are those who are going to turn these attitudes into action, which we have seen and which we see increasingly. So things are bad. And again, another anecdote. I remember the ambassador of Israel to London, who said that, "Listen, I have two daughters. One just joined the IDF. The other is here in London. She went into central London clubbing the other night. I was more worried for my daughter in London."
And what was the response by his interlocutor?
Yeah, I mean, we are shocked, of course, to hear those things, and I think the European political class don't want to grasp this message, how bad it is, because they are partly part of the problem. We like to always differentiate and say, well, yes, anti-Semitism, the way we always understood it, the anti-Semite would dress in brown. Either he was a skinhead or he had a little mustache. But then, when you saw anti-Semitism appearing in a very different form and shape, we couldn't recognize it anymore. And I think this is the big educational challenge in Europe, to really understand, to go back to the late Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, to understand what does anti-Semitism looks like today, the mutated form where human rights is the basis of accusing Jews for all these evils that has been taught through centuries. The bloodthirsty Jews, the Jews who control the world, the wealthy Jews, so on and so forth. And I think now we really see this version 2.0, and it's ugly, and I think it has surprised everyone, and it's so widespread.
So I'm going to ask you several questions down, kind of down the line, but the first part of this would be how much of this has to do with immigration floods into Europe? I mean, Europe has seen enormous waves of people, which is not always a bad thing. In fact, in the United States, it's been a very healthy thing for many, many years. What kind of influence does major immigration from the Middle East and Africa have to do with this?
I think there are two sources for today's anti-Semitism. This is the primary source. And I think everyone would acknowledge that today, even in Germany. And there are ideas to put this into legislation, I think both in Sweden and the Netherlands, that in order to become, say, a Swedish citizen, you should acknowledge the right of the Jewish people to have their own national home,
Really?
state, yes. So about 10 years ago, when we had this flooding of unvetted refugees coming into Europe, the mode was very, very different, and no one seemed to see any problems with that. But now, in each country, people are waking up to reality. We also see this, how it turns out in elections from the Netherlands to Germany and across Europe. I mean, this is one of the number one questions that we are dealing with. But apart from Islamic jihadists or simply Muslims who were brought up, indoctrinated in hating Jews, we have the other form of, if you call it neo-Marxist anti-Semitism, which, through the Long March, through the institutions, are now in most of the faculties in universities in across Europe, and are at the forefront or of legitimizing anti-Semitism in a way. I used to call this the sophisticated anti-Semitism, and so I think what people have difficulties understanding is really when you see a jihadist on the street, you know that this is we have a problem. Obviously, when you see a neo-Nazi with a shaved head, you understand there's a problem. But when you see the most intelligent, the most well-educated, best-dressed academics and media pundits and political leaders more or less starting to say or imply the same things, that's when it gets really difficult. And it's difficult then for normal citizens to say, well, listen, these are the people I always looked up to. If they are of this conviction right now, who am I to say that they are wrong? And I would even say the latest example, the new Chancellor Merz in Germany.
So that was going to be the second step down this pike. It's what we call in the United States intersectionalism. It's the coming together of a variety of ideologies and people and thought processes, mostly from the left, but not always, mostly from the left, academia, all of that. First of all, it's not clear to me how the Islamists got in with these people because most of the things, or many of the things, that the left wing in Europe and in the United States stand for are things that Islamists don't. Women's rights, gay rights, all kinds of education. How did they get together? I have yet to find anybody who understands how they get together except on the issue of Jew hatred. Neither of them like Jews.
No, I think you implied the answer there. The Jews, of course, always a very unifying force for hatred. But not only the Jews. I mean, we're talking about the Western world. We're talking about liberal democracy. We're talking about the United States. If you look at the haters, and we have to put this, I think, in a bigger picture, that there are many segments in European society who just instinctively hate the US. first for liberating Europe from the Nazis.
Oh.
So if you had Nazi sympathies, of course, you will never forget that or forgive that. But then you also had the hardcore Marxists will never forget that, Reagan was responsible for bringing down the Iron Curtain, and these, together make up a significant electorate. So I think instinctively there is this U.S. hatred in Europe, which also seems to go very much hand in hand with the big Satan and the small Satan. So there is, even if you would take the Jewish question out of the equation, there is even a bigger problem, a civilizational problem in Europe, where you have these anti-Western coalitions doing everything they can to bring down, what we have considered the free world. And it doesn't matter if you're an Islamist or if you're a communist or a neo-Marxist or something in between, as long as you have a common enemy.
So, which is obviously something Americans do not want to hear. I would say that my father fought in Europe for the liberation of Europe. And I've always thought of us as kind of partners in the world. But you make a very interesting point because if you didn't like that and you didn't want to be, quote, liberated either from communism or from Nazism, then who are you mad at? And the Jewish thing also. I don't know if you've ever read The Israel Test by George Gilder. People who watch this show know that I'm very big on George Gilder. And Gilder says that part of it has to do with the successes that Israel has had, that Israel used to be the darling of the West when it was poor and socialist. It's not poor and socialist anymore. It's rich and capitalist, and therefore it hops over to the other side. The United States also is not a socialist country. So I think that's a crucial point. There may be a dividing line between us and people in Europe, us meaning Americans, and people we think of as our brothers. But
Well,
maybe.
I would go one step further,
That's
maybe.
scary. You would go further than I just went.
Because I would say, and I've said this publicly, that Europe love dead Jews. That's why 27th of January is such a big day. We have everyone for the Holocaust International Remembrance Day, coming together, saying, never again, this is terrible what happened, so on and so forth. Of course, criticizing Israel at the same time. I just made a statement in the European Parliament to say that Israeli Independence Day should be the big day. But there's nothing happening in the European capitals of Israeli Independence Day. And again, as I think it was Ruth Weiss who said that if you don't understand the connection between the liberation of Auschwitz and what happened with the reestablishment of the Jewish national home in Israel, you missed everything. And I think that's the problem with Europe. We missed everything. We stop at 27 January, the liberation of Auschwitz. That was it. And what we tend to say is that, as a result, we built the European Union because this would never then happen again. We would live in peace and harmony. But as for what happened with the Jews who survived, why can't we just acknowledge that and celebrate that and say that, well, listen, if there's anything we need to learn from the Holocaust, is that, hey, let's support those Jews who are alive and make them thrive. Why is that so difficult? So that leads me to my provocative statement. Europe loves dead Jews. They have a problem with Jews who are alive, who are successful, who are strong, who are fighting back. And we see this now in the situation in Gaza and the Middle East.
Yeah, we'll get to Gaza in a minute, but I still want to keep parsing Europe
Course.
because I think there's a line somewhere. So all of those Western European countries after World War II had this experience, and Central European countries had a different experience. And their experience being under communism and then liberating themselves, I mean, we didn't do it. I have to say, Ronald Reagan was great. He's my hero. But Russian people and Central European people had their own uprising. There is much less of this, what you just described as Western Europeanism. There's also less intersectionalism. There's also less left-wing ism in the universities. Is, first of all, is that a result of their experience after World War II? Are they more likely to end up our good allies than the other guys? And secondly, how does that translate into their respect for nationalism, for borders, for homelands, for patriotic activity, a lot of which would make them natural supporters of Israel?
Yeah, it's true, and it's obvious, first of all, that Central Eastern European countries, the new member states of the European Union, have a completely different experience of Israel. And when we look, as we do with our organization, at voting patterns and where are our friends, take a country like Estonia. By and large, you have bipartisan support for Israel. It doesn't, or Romania, even a better example. It doesn't matter if you're a socialist, you're center right, or anything else. You just have this appreciation of Israel. And I remember one Czech diplomat explaining this to me, and he said that, listen, it's not that difficult. During the communist times, we saw the Palestinians, they were here in Prague, they were being trained by our secret service. So it wasn't difficult to identify who are our friends, who are less friendly. And even when we got our independence and there were talks about the Palestinian state. So this is all true. Also, when it comes to men, I usually look at Europe and Israel, generally speaking, that when it comes to the issue of nationalism, when it comes to issues of peace and war, the conclusion after the Second World War in Europe was no more wars, regardless of evil. And I think, obviously, there's some merit to that, to say that that war was terrible, and we can't just slip into a war, with very strong convictions. But we also know that in Europe today, we're looking, say, for Britain. They have very small percentages of the population who said, "I would defend Britain if Britain was ever attacked." We're talking about very small numbers. Then you have Israel, who had a very different, again, now speaking about nationalism, experience of nationalism after 1948, when we were starting to deconstruct our nationalism. They were building their national movement, and this is, of course, something which still today is almost like the core question: how do we look at borders, national identity, and also, is there anything in the world worth fighting for? If you ask a British, a young German, they would say, "No, I'm not willing to go out in a war to fight for Germany. What is Germany? What are, German borders, peoplehood?" If you ask that to a young Israelis, they understand this is a life existential issue, and that is, of course, what is playing out, that we are from different planets with very different experience.
Different experiences and different plans for the future, I think. But how do you square that? This is off the a little bit off the track. How do you square that with Great Britain and France wanting so badly to be involved in the Ukraine war? And I'm not commenting on the war or on the Russians, but clearly the UK and France have been pushing toward more arms for Ukraine, more help for Ukraine and all of that. But if there's nothing worth fighting for, what are they doing?
In some way, it's simple. It's not the French who are fighting, is it? It's
No.
not the British. So, of course, there's a sacrifice in military expenditure. But if you would rephrase the question and said, would the British or the French be willing to fight a war with Russia, for example? You know, I'm not so sure you will get many, many voluntary recruits.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's somebody else's war. We can support someone
It
else.
it's
Let them go fight their war.
exactly, and it's still for me, and this may seem a bit unorthodox in saying that, but it's still fighting for something quite vague, an idea, if we call it the you know, rule of law, international system, but clearly not an existential issue.
Certainly not for the UK and France.
No.
But that does raise a question for you in the European context, or a question for me, and you can answer it. You and the European Commission for Israel, you do go to these institutions in Europe, and you make the case for the support of Israel and against anti-Semitism and all that. So what do you want from, for example, the European Union? Or the ICC or the ICE. First of all, tell us who you go and talk to. And secondly, what is it that you want from them? And third, and most important, how do they respond to you? You show up, you say, you guys are not helping here. You are not. What do they say to you?
Yeah. Well, first they ask who we are. And this is always the interesting anecdote that someone would speak up for Israel. So they said, "So you're an Israeli organization?" And we said, "Well, we're actually not." And they said, "Oh, so you're only a Jewish organization?" And we said, "Well, we're actually not." Then they get really confused, and then they say, "Oh, now I get it. You're an American organization." And we said, "Actually, we're not." So that's a good conversation starter. First of all, that, you know, I'm not Jewish, I'm not American, I'm Finnish, I'm European, and I feel deeply for these issues. And I think that's a good conversation starter. So we speak mostly then to European Union institutions, meaning members of Parliament, European Commission, European External Action Service, but also national governments and parliaments.
You too.
Yeah. And of course, keep in mind we're a small organization, but you know, we're punching over our weight. If I would say, because the messaging, of course, varies from year to year, from situation to situation, my key message today would be to say, hey, because now it's all about Gaza and anti-Semitism, you know, is somewhere in the background, but it's almost like there's a justification for anti-Semitism. I just received an email from a friend a few hours ago, and I read it, and I'd been in the debate in Finland, and I expressed my concern about the rise of anti-Semitism. And this person said that, well, I always had a sense that, you know, anti-Semitism would rise, you know, over time. But now I understand that I didn't understand then that there could be a legitimate reason for it. And I just froze when I read that, because this is a staunch supporter of Israel, used to be. All of a sudden, you're saying, well, wait a minute. Now I can understand why there is anti-Semitism. So what I would then say is, listen, on October 8th, Emmanuel Macron went out, said publicly, we need to build a coalition just like we did against ISIS to defeat Hamas. My question is, why has this been forgotten? Why is there not an international coalition to fight what is not Israel's war only? As Jose Maria Aznar says, you know, if Israel falls, we all fall. Why is there not this sense of community? Because then, you know, since international community seems to know so much better than Israel how to do it, you know, let's avoid all the civilian casualties and do it in a wonderful, beautiful way, defeat Hamas. So for me, it comes back to this. The failure starts there. If you're not willing to get involved in this civilizational battle, just keep quiet. That's our message.
Keeping quiet has never been the strong suit of anybody's government. But I would say to you, and to your pro-Israel friend who said, I understand it, I also understand it. And I really do think that this is largely attributable to the prevalence of media and social media, because we are being fed an enormous number of lies. You know the story about a tank shelling at the aid station, and they killed 31 people with tank shells. The BBC reported this. And then the doctor that the BBC quoted said it was all gunshot wounds. Now, if you're a serious journalist, you don't have a tank attack that results in gunshot wounds. Tanks don't fire bullets. But they went with it anyway, and the story stayed up for 3 days, and then they changed it. The Washington Post took down their story on the tank shelling. They took it down. And why? They didn't say they were wrong. They said it didn't meet our standard for fairness. In other words, we didn't give the Israelis enough time to answer us or something, whatever it meant. So what I think is different now is that you have a flood of information, and this goes with your academics, and it goes with the left wing, and it goes with the governments, that all of this is willing to push propaganda. And then you really can't blame people for being suckered because that's all they get. You have other sources. I have other sources. I hope you guys out there have other sources. We're one of your sources. But a lot of people just take what they get. And that's really frightening because among the last things I would like to see is censorship of the media. I'd like for them to be more responsible themselves. I don't want to see us censoring them. So, what do you get though when you push back? You go to see a European government or a parliamentarian, and you say, sir, I'm sorry, but you've been snookered by bad information. What does that parliamentarian say to you?
Well, they do listen. And again, there's a wide range. Are we talking about the extreme left? Are we talking about, center right? I think, currently, if we then look at the traditional Friends of Israel on the center right, what we need to, and they read the same media reports that most people read, which are not always very helpful. And I think, a politician is not necessarily mostly concerned about what is right or wrong.
What are they concerned about?
They are concerned about being reelected. So we've heard this so many times that, and I think this is true, that obviously there's a greater understanding in some pockets of, from the political class, especially in Germany. And they would always say, listen, I'm a staunch supporter of Israel. I will always be. My concern should be your concern, the streets of Europe. We are losing the streets of Europe. If this is true, I won't be reelected and you get someone else. So it's not, I mean, politics, it's upstream. So, if we lose, the European street, of course, this will be reflected in who are their elected representatives.
So, talk about elected representatives. You guys monitor elections across Europe. Who's winning? Who's losing? Sometimes we do see a Polish election. I would like you to comment on the Polish election because I don't think most Americans paid attention to it, but I thought it was interesting. Who's up and who's down? Is Macron, for example, and I'm just picking on him because I want to. Is Macron lashing out at Israel because he is in trouble at home?
I would say that literally he is in trouble at home
He is in
with
trouble.
his wife.
Well, that's a
And
different problem.
broader than that, yes. Of course, I mean, if you just think of what I just said, you don't win elections by being pro-Israel,
Right.
especially in a country which has the largest proportionally Muslim population, and also then a strong leftist element. But there is the other side. And I think you probably have questions about that later, but what we will call the populist movement. So there is a reaction where Israel is also somewhere in that equation against political establishment like Macron, his policies. And I think, and that was my article that I wrote for you a few months ago, that these are groups that we need to identify, understand them, but also engage with them. There are certain red lines, people you cannot speak with, but there are also others that are simply being neglected because the pressure to demonize them has been, again, with the same media apparatus, has just been too strong. So in our we did, as you know, an EU Israel vote ranking, so we can clearly see which parties, which nations are where do they stand
Wait
on the
one second.
ranking?
I want to say to the listeners that Thomas wrote a great article in Focus magazine about how this works, and you should go and look it up. But for the moment, would you explain about the vote ranking and how that
Of
works?
course. So the vote ranking, this was the first time done ever in the European Parliament. So we had a professional research institute identifying each vote, and also vote on amendments, which had to do with Israel, the security of Israel. So based on this data, we could rank, I think, 170 political parties in the European Parliament. And it's very clear, it goes from the right to the left. And as it was said in Wall Street Journal earlier today by this editor from Bild-Zeitung, that conservative right seems to be like the last bastion of hope for Israel in Europe today. And that's, by the way, why the recent comments by Merz are so alarming and of such great concern. But in some way, there's an explanation to that, because what we found was that the CDU, which you were, if I would ask you which party would be strongest, and you would perhaps say the German Christian Democrats, CDU, and they were not.
Really?
Yeah, so they were more in the, not in the middle, on the right, right bottom of the ranking, but they were not the real supporters.
So who were the real supporters?
Yeah, so you then have often they can be rather small parties. So you have something like there's a Christian party in the Netherlands, which often part of the government coalition. They're extremely pro-Israel. Then you have in Italy, as you know, all of the three coalition partners, which are center-right and right wing parties, are very supportive. I think actually the most supportive one was Vox in Spain, and I know there's a debate on who Vox are with their past. But clearly, if you look at the vote ranking, they were first or second. We did it 2 years. Then you have the Sweden Democrats, which again are part of the government coalition in Sweden, extremely supportive. So you have, some would call, on the fringes, but the fringes are becoming mainstream in Europe.
Except possibly in France, where they wouldn't let Le Pen run. I mean, is this something, now this is like a broader question, not a France question. Is there a concern that if left-leaning European governments who think they're right, not just about Israel, but about lots of things, see a rise in center-right and right voting, that we have a problem with democracy in France? They've ruined the Romanian elections. They kept Le Pen out, they're keeping Le Pen out of the current elections. Is there a problem with democracy in Europe? And what does that mean when we look forward?
That's a good question. Depending on how I answer, I may get in trouble
Oh,
back
I
in
don't want you
Europe.
to get in trouble, but I do
No,
want you to be
yeah,
honest. So if it
of
gets you in
course,
trouble,
yeah.
I can't
No,
help it.
no, no, no. Yeah. Okay, so again, the question is, where are the red lines? Democracy, unlimited, if it means that the people will have their way, without any checks and balances, of course, doesn't always work. And we saw that in Germany in the 1930s. But I think this example is being used too casually today, anytime your opponent wins. And it's not easy, not even for me, take the example of Romania, to be 100% sure, where you put your money. Only thing I can say is that it's never as black and white as either side would imply. So if you look at some of the current right-wing elements in Central Eastern Europe, there are, I would say it's within the parties. That is the question. So many parties, the question is, do you have mechanism for excluding those who are openly anti-Semitic, for example,
Within the party.
within the party? So sometimes, you don't win elections by doing it. So I think the smart people, so to speak, they said, well, wait a minute. These are crazy people. We don't listen to them. We know they are lunatics, but we need that 1, 2, 3% that they can bring to the table. Are they then mechanism to say, well, listen, we will never be influenced by what you say, we have a clear policy, but if the question is between winning and losing an election, will we somehow involve this group? Then it's a strategic question where most would say, let's do it and make sure we win the elections. Okay, the follow-up question to myself would then be, well, where is the line of what you turn a blind eye to within the party? And this is a much deeper and more complex question. I had a friend, quote unquote, in the European Parliament, who used to be one of the founders, more or less, of AfD in Germany. But he told me, he said, listen, when these radical voices started to speak up, being very anti-Semitic, I said, I can no longer lead the party, so I'm leaving. And I think on a personal level, that's a morally very, encouraging sign that there are those who are even willing to give up political career to stay true to one's ideals. But I think this is true for most parties right now in Europe, and I mean for the US for that matter.
Well, yes. First of all, I have to say that your explanation of the right in Europe saying, we won't listen to them, but we need them, to help us get elected is exactly the same as your explanation of pro-Israel politicians on the left in Europe who need, the votes. Yes, we have the same concern here. There are parts of the Democratic Party, and I know personally there are Democrats who are very, very disturbed by the Democratic Party and the leanings against Israel. And then there are people on the right and then the Republican Party. I think the difference, and here you may be better off than we are, is that we have two parties. Basically, yes, an independent can win. It's possible, but it's not very likely. Bernie Sanders does win. He's not really an independent. He's a communist, but never mind. In Europe, you have choices, more choices. And so I'm not sure how it goes, but I see the same strains that you're concerned about showing up right here. Do I stay in my party and try to make it better? Do I leave my party? And if I leave my party, where am I going? Okay, I'm going to save the optimist pessimist question for later. I'm going to go off on a different place, South Africa. Because you've had some things to say, the coalition has had some things to say about South Africa. They're on a real rag about Israel, and they have been for a while. International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice. Who supports them in Europe to do these things? Where does this come from that a country that is not a European country shows up and says, And Israel is not a member of the court, so the
Mm.
court actually doesn't have any jurisdiction. How did this happen?
Mm.
Why are Europeans listening to the South Africans on this? What's going on here?
Yeah. There, I think I may have a rational explanation. Speaking as a Finn, what our foreign minister would say that for us the international rule of law system is absolutely essential for small countries like Finland. And they would then say, if we weaken these institutions like ICC or ICJ, we're in real trouble when it comes to dealing with Russia. So there is the, so they are willing in a way to turn a blind eye to the Israel case because they think that, one day, rather sooner than later, we may need it to deal with Putin after the war in Ukraine. So they said, well, if we don't have anything which is functioning, then we are in real trouble and the system is broken completely. So there's a logic to that, of course, but it's not complete. And when I say that they would turn a blind eye, it's not the whole truth. I mean, they, on a greater scale, of course, South Africa is one of the most vicious, aggressively anti-Israel countries today in the whole world. And of course, European countries are not, on that level, but they're catching up, let's put it this way. And when it comes to the understanding or perception, I should say that, hey, we need to deal with the Israelis. And of course, they can quote Ehud Olmert. They can quote, many Israeli intellectuals and saying that, listen, we need to bring these, the prime minister to Hague. And it's not a difficult sell in Europe.
That's interesting. So it's not a difficult sell.
It's not a difficult sell.
Then why do if a country like Finland, which I get it, it's a small country next to a large country and a large country with whom they've had wars, but if a small country feels that it needs protection in the larger scheme of international justice, why is nobody standing up for the small countries of Africa where Christians are being killed at a disgusting rate, at a genocidal rate. If you want to talk about where there's genocide and where there's famine, it's Africa. Why does that not get into the court, but Israel gets into the court? Is there.
I mean, good question. I learned this late in the game, but nevertheless, I learned it that politics is not about morality, it's not about ethics. Forget it. It's about national interest. And the smaller the countries are, the more concrete this is. And perhaps I just avoid mentioning particular states, but when you have a Russian bear on the other side of the borders, you think of only one thing. You don't think about what is right or wrong in Africa. I mean, it's cynical.
No, but it's also self-preservation. You say, okay, that's a shame. I feel bad about that. But I sit here.
Exactly. Exactly. Realpolitik.
It didn't work very well for Ukraine, however. And somebody ought to be looking at that and saying, yes, I understand why you don't want to poke the Russian bear. I understand why you want to keep the mechanism for defending small countries. But it didn't work in that case. What are we going to do now? And
I think the thinking in these European countries is that, there's going to be a day when the dust will settle and we have to deal with the legal proceedings after the war. I mean, again, it's wishful thinking, but that's at least how they think.
okay. I'm starting to move the mountain here because as we get closer to the program, I like to look for more optimistic things to think about, and this is not an optimistic program, I have to tell you. And you're not the first. I mean, we've had not very optimistic programs. So a number of European countries have announced they're going to recognize the Palestinian state. They have no idea what the borders would be. They have no idea who's going to run it. They don't know if it's going to be Hamas that runs it. They don't sort of think about whether they're rewarding Hamas for October 7th or not. They're just not there. They just want to recognize. Palestine. And the French and the British said that as well. Now Macron and the UK, they say they want to have a meeting with Israel. They want to have a discussion about futures and things like that. And I guess to short circuit what the Israelis were going to laugh at them for, Macron announced that there will be no discussion of a Palestinian state in this meeting. And I thought, well, is that good news? And if it is good news, fine. Maybe he's figured out you can't have a meeting with Israel if you're going to talk about a Palestinian state in the middle of the war. But maybe it's bad news. What else could they be talking about? So is there some possibility that, frankly, I do think people are understanding now that there was no famine in Gaza and there is no genocide in Gaza, and the Palestinians, actually, the number of Palestinians grew over the last 2 years, which would be the weirdest genocide in the world. Is there some understanding building that they might have jumped too fast, and that now we need to be rational about how to deal with the aftermath of October 7th and the war and Hamas?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that in just what is it, 2 weeks' time, the 19th of well, 3 weeks' time, 19th of June, there will be this UN meeting, UN conference, I should say, about a two-state solution, where the goal has been to create a pathway to irrevocable to statehood, but also where Macron, I think, is looking at one of the scenarios that this would be the time and place where Britain and France would recognize a Palestinian state, which of course would create a completely new situation geopolitically in Europe. It would be very difficult for smaller nations not to do it. But this is really my message in this program and to Washington. There's only one government administration in the world that can keep this from happening. And it's here in Washington, D.C. And I think this is really the time for the administration to send a clear signal to Europe, to the capitals, to say, this is a no-go. It won't, we all know it won't create peace. It will only make the situation worse. But also, more importantly, to say, listen, if you want to maintain good relations with the US in the context of NATO, in the context of a security arrangement, this is not going to bring you closer to US. It won't increase the understanding that we are on the same side of history. So I think these next 2 weeks are really critical, and this message needs to be heard in Helsinki, in London, in Paris, everywhere. And the good, we wanted to be optimistic.
I do.
The good news is that they are listening.
How do you know they're listening? We as Americans do not think they're listening. What makes you think they are?
They're listening. I mean, of course, we can't move forward without the United States. It's as simple as that. And if this administration is very clear in what their intentions are, how they want to move forward, what are the red lines, you know, this is the best chance for moving forward in the right direction. You know, finding an end to the war in Gaza, trying to see how we move on from there in the context of the Abraham Accords and who know what. It would be very detrimental for your administration if it would take another direction. It would be very difficult to bring them back to the table and look at the different scenario. But it's time sensitive. And I think the key is really here with your foreign secretary, with the president, of course, Speaker of the House, and I really hope and pray that the U.S. will play its card in the right way.
I don't have any doubt that the US administration would agree with you that we don't want to go in that direction. That is not us. That's not our policy. And we don't want anyone else to either. The question I think that I would have, and other people I think have, is whether they will do it overtly or covertly, or do it at all. There is a case, not because they don't believe it. I think they are truly on the right side of this. But they also have a tendency not to want to get involved in certain things. And so you have to ask yourself, are they going to risk? They're already having serious conversations with France and Britain about Ukraine. They're having serious conversations with Germany about NATO and about NATO participation and NATO spending and NATO weaponry and all of that. I think that, and here I ruin my chance of going out on a positive note. I wonder if it's not too much for them to now take up the flag for Israel and say we can't have a conversation about a two-state solution. I don't know. I mean,
Oh, okay, so well, first of all, I hope you're wrong,
I do
but
too.
I would modify. I mean, your last sentence. Let's start from there. Yes, you can and you should have a conversation about, call it, the two-state solution. That's not a problem. And I think even as it relates to the UN conference, the 19th of June, whatever, if they want to have an international conference, they had many, by the way, over the years. It's not
Yes.
the first one.
Yes.
They can do so, but there cannot be any unilateral declarations of a Palestinian state at this point, which would make the process irrevocable. And I think that's simple message. So it's not to say that you can't engage. Please do engage. But be clear to say, where are the red lines?
That's a very good point. Where are the red lines? I don't know. I have no idea where the red lines are. I will say, by the way, for the administration, that they vetoed a Security Council resolution yesterday that would have ended the war in Gaza. I mean, without saying how the war should end, without saying who's the winner and what happens to the hostages, and lost in all of this, are the hostages, and there are still living people. We hope there's still living people there. But the US did stand up and say no.
Speaking strategically, obviously, I think they will continue to veto in the Security Council. What I'm saying is, you have to go beyond that. You have to be proactive, and that's when I'm really that's my message as I am meeting here in Washington today and tomorrow, that you isolation is not the answer. You need a proactive engagement with your allies. Speak with them. You have the leverage. You can make this world a better place. Use your leverage in the right way.
That, Thomas, I am going to accept as a positive. I'm also going to accept as positive the fact that I could be wrong, and I want to be wrong in this case. I want you to be right. And I want to thank you for coming on the program and doing a great job of helping us see where we are alike and where we are different. Americans, I think, either think of Europeans as just like us, which they're not, or they think of them as alien beings, which they're also not. So this helps. I mean, it gives us a better foundation for what we need to understand in the world as we try to navigate as friends of America, of Europe, and specifically of Israel and Jewish people. Thank you. Now, a word to the viewers. We have a couple of questions here that we did not get to. I promise you that those questions will go to Thomas and I will get us an answer. And watch your inbox because next week, I've been invited back to the RJC to do a podcast for them with Cliff May. Cliff May is always fabulous, the head of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, FDD. And I'm looking forward to having that opportunity. I want to use that as our webinar. I have to go try to work it out, I mean, logistically and every other way. So keep an eye on your inbox, and we will let you know at what point you can see the Cliff May podcast. Thank you all for joining us. And again, Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you.